The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler, the News and Observer, and AAA Go Magazine. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that will be featured in the articles we will be reading. They are selected merely for your enjoyment and edification. Now, our journey today is going to start with a story by travel writer and photographer Gately Williams. He lives in Charleston, South Carolina, and plans to cross the country from Oregon to Virginia this June in the Trans Am bike race. But this is not Williams' first cross-country trek. In the caption to the cover photo of his article, Epic Drives Across the USA, in the April-May 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler, the editors write, in 2014, Gately Williams set off on a cross-country trip in a station wagon to photograph all 50 states. He says the Valley of the Gods in southern Utah was a high point. It's also the cover photo for his article about his quest to visit every U.S. state on 16 cross-country road trips via car, motorbike, and pink bicycle. And Williams has more to say in his introduction. Stillness dreams of movement, and being at home makes me yearn for the desert of southern Utah at 60 miles an hour in a 30-year-old station wagon I call Irene. My cross-country drives have been quite diverse. There was the one in a 95 Toyota Corolla with an old girlfriend. A moving truck and a best friend took me on the southern route. I jump-started my adventure versions by riding a pink bicycle from Maine to Baja, California. A red Ducati took me 7,000 miles in 27 days. We circled the whole U.S. map. In the summer of 2016, four friends and I tested our dirt bikes off-road across America. In all, I've crossed 16 times. It was Irene that gave me the time and the pace, as space rather, to slow down. We set out in April 2014 with my goal to photograph all 50 states, which put a check mark on my bucket list. I had learned from my previous rambles that this would have to be a long enough trip to allow me to find my rhythm. I needed to be out there a while to get tired of it, then settle in again. The more I saw, the more there was to see. With the exception of my flights to Hawaii and Alaska without it, that old wagon made the 25,000-mile drive with just a couple of routine repairs, not bad for a $2,300 rig. Breaking down in Yosemite Valley was not a horrible way to spend a day with a gal I met at Salvation Mountain. We napped in the grass with our chins pointed high at Half Dome. I learned the importance of not overplanning a long journey. I always had a safe place to lie down at night in the back of the wagon and ample storage for my cameras and boots. My mountain bike was strapped on the rear. I linked the addresses of friends and family into a rough line I drew across a map aiming for specific regions of each state. In the spaces between, I'd usually find what I didn't know I was looking for. In Colorado, I parked at a friend's house and made the dirt road town of Ridgway home for 2 months. I rode my bicycle uphill to Telluride, drank lots of coffee in town, and made new friends. At night, we ate Mexican food and stripped down at the hot springs on the south side of town. In Hawaii, I joined my buddy Bray and her community for a week, and they gave me a birthday cake for no reason. In Jackson, Wyoming, I fell asleep under the sun in a sled pulled by dogs. One evening in Oregon was spent on an old bus looking out the Pacific with a group of Canadians. In California, I saw stars in the afternoon after crashing my bicycle on the Pacific Coast Highway. In Idaho, I met a photographer I had always admired, and he led me to the Bruno Canyon, think Grand Canyon but green. I watched a red moon in a field outside Austin with my new friend Chelsea, whose mom I had met on a plane the year before. Outside of Big Bend National Park, I followed the Rio Grande and the border of Mexico, heading west and north to New Mexico. In Indiana, I held my friend's new baby and visited my parents. In Alaska, I played slip and slide on the Mananuska Glacier before dancing all night in hope. The town is so small and cozy that I camped across the Seaview Cafe on Main Street. In New Orleans, I submitted to the crowds on Bourbon Street. With my dear friend Sean, I stayed up all night and ate beignets at a Café du Monde before the sun rose. East of Seattle, I caught a fish, and with the help of a local, we gutted, cooked, and ate it. These moments are special to me because of the people I shared with them. And there were days and states where I was completely alone. Those quiet, sometimes lonely nights made the special moments grander. Yet I often savored the quiet after the days spent with others. I was completely selfish and made each decision with and for myself. There are infinite routes and versions of a road trip. For me, it's about going far, being a little vulnerable, and coming home with a bit more to me. Well, a second photo found in William's introduction shows him solo camping in southern Mississippi, and as he notes, all these simple experiences gave me confidence in a gentle and compassion for our country. The photo shows a station wagon, a well-lit campfire, and a yellow North Face tent in a remote wooded area of Mississippi. And we turn the page to find yet a two-page color photo showing bikers at a storied biker bar on the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu, California. Neptune's Net, which appeared in the first Fast and Furious film. And says Williams, as a motorcyclist myself, I was in heaven. On to the next page, where we find 14 photos from Williams' cross-country trek, and I'm going to first share with you the captions for these 14. Number one, a sled dog in Jackson, Wyoming. This is a gorgeous dog, and he's atop one of those old cable things like the telephone companies use to unravel cable when they're installing cable outdoors, and the dog's just standing on top. And then number two is a cowboy roping a calf at a rodeo in Norwood, Colorado, with a crowd looking on. Number three is an abandoned school in Montana. That has an interesting connotation that we'll explain in a few moments. And then we move on to visiting friends in northern Indiana. And number five is Canadians in Oregon at sunrise, and they're atop a school bus. And then number six is Yosemite National Park, California, in June. And number seven is on a country road in southern Florida. The eighth photograph, Delicate Arch in Arches National Park, Utah, and that is indeed delicate. It's quite spectacular to look at that, and he has some further comments about that in just a moment. Number nine, enjoying happy hour at a friend's house in Oahu, Hawaii. 10, winding mountain journey up to Crater Lake, Oregon. Number 11, my friend Bray in Oahu leaping into the sea at Lanikai Beach. Now, this is a spectacular photo. It's a huge rock wall, and she is in the center of it, and she's almost a dot, but you see enough of her to know she's just plunging down into the water below. Quite a shot. And then warming up by the teepee fire at the Hicksville Trailer Palace and Artist Retreat, Joshua Tree, California. Where else but California would you find that? Number 13, a not very busy gas station in Hollis, Oklahoma. And number 14, watching the tide recede in Rockport, Massachusetts. Now, as I've said, Williamson's added some special annotations, rather, to some of the photographs. Let me share those with you. The first one, somewhere in northern Montana, I spotted the remnants of an old schoolhouse and had to investigate. This old schoolhouse is quite something. At first glance, you might think it's a barn, but it's actually the shell of a schoolhouse, and you can actually see the little bell that was used to ring in the classes sitting atop one end of this old thing with the prairie dunes in the background. And then you've got him holding this little toddler way up high toward the sun. He says, meeting my friend's son for the first time in northern Indiana. The sun was shining and we had a Lion King moment. How precious is that? And now we have this old converted school bus and all the writing has been gone over and erased. It's just yellow and black striped, but a good looking job, I'll have to say. And there's four folks sitting on top of this school bus. And these four Canadian friends, he writes, drove a small school bus through the states, and we shared a night parked at the beach in Oregon. And then there's this spectacular shot of a waterfall in the center of this absolutely sheer drop cliff side of a mountain. I spent a sunny afternoon in Yosemite Valley. I will never be able to recreate this day, and I wouldn't even dream of trying. Then we moved to Florida, where you've got this picture of this bull eyeing him very steadily with a kind of a, you got to say, In Florida, the livestock stared at me and my big camera for a change. And then let's go to that Arches National Park, Utah. The beauty is evident in 360-degree views, and that is not, that's almost an understatement. If you can put yourself into this picture, you can turn in any direction and get a view, I mean an eyeful, as they say. And a three-mile hike brought him to that delicate arch, which is gorgeous. The wind and time and other factors of nature have worn this it's like an arch. It's rock. It's naturally formed. And the fantastic thing is there's a delicate part where it's been worn over time, and it's very thin and narrow compared to the other side that's holding it up, but yet it's standing there. And then you got people at the base, so it's huge. It's huge. It's got to be several stories tall. And then he says, I flew out to Oahu, Hawaii, where new friends taught me how not to wear shirt or shoes, and they're all waving goodbye to him in shorts only outside of their place that they were staying. And his final annotation is, although it's no longer busy, this service station in Hollis, Oklahoma stands as it did in the 1950s and retro 50s it is. It's the kind of place, you know, you pulled in up under the awning, and one side you get out to go into the service station, maybe to grab a soda or something, and then there's the pumps as you could pull in. And you see this design in place all over North Carolina from the 50s forward, so it's not an unusual thing to find. So there we go. Well, we've had some fun so far. Now comes the key article, and this is called The 50 States Road Trips. Now, what we're going to do is feature the first 10 states on today's Armchair Traveler, and then the remainder will be covered in future episodes. And we're going to begin with the state of Alaska. So here we go. Alaska Highway was the focus. Wild, remote, and backdropped by spruce forests and snow-capped mountains, the Alaska Highway, or ALCAN, stretches nearly 1,400 miles from Dawson Creek, British Columbia, north to Delta Junction, Alaska. Consult Road Bible, The Milepost, before setting off on what is arguably the king of all North American road trips. Our second stop is just brief here because it's the Pacific Coast Highway, L.A. to Santa Cruz. There is actually a full article, which we will read in a future episode. It's called On the Road to Big Sur, and illustrator Gene Julian helped him on this one. So we will have that a little later in a future episode. But anyway, it's the Pacific Coast Highway, Los Angeles to Santa Cruz. Now on to Colorado, the third listing here. Top of the Rockies Scenic Byway. Take in Tower Rocky Mountain peaks, blue alpine lakes, and two crossings of the Continental Divide, and 122 scenic miles. Stop for pizza at High Mountain Peas in Leadville, elevation 10,200 feet, a former hub for silver mining. And driving up to Evergreen in the Rockies outside of Denver one time, it was amazing to me. Every switchback had a different view as you went from just maybe 3,000 or 4,000 feet all the way up to 8,000 feet. And that's only halfway, because many of those peaks are between 13,000 and 15,000 feet, including Pikes Peak, which I was able to see on one of the switchbacks. So quite a view out there on that scenic byway. Then we go to Hawaii. Kapalua and Kahakalua, West Maui. This twisty 14-mile drive called Hawaii 30 to Hawaii 340 is an easier alternative to the legendary Haina Highway. Although this route doesn't have the breadth and depth of Haina, it requires less time in the car if you're staying in the Lahaina area, and you still get a sense of what Maui looked like before resorts, says photographer Susan Schubert. And the Haina Highway is quite something. I've been on part of it, but not the whole run. If I get back to Hawaii, I definitely want to try it. Number five is Idaho. Northwest Passage Scenic Byway, Lewiston to Lolo Pass, U.S. 12. Follow in the footsteps of Lewis and Clark on a 202-mile photographer's dream drive through the rugged heart of north-central Idaho. The route leads through wilderness areas, follows multiple branches of two wild and scenic rivers, crosses the Nez Perce Reservation, and ends at the forested and meandering 5,233-foot high Lolo Pass at the Montana border. Wow, talk about an Old West adventure. Then we go to Kansas. Flint Hills National Scenic Byway, Council Grove to Cassoday. Cruise 48 miles through the nearly treeless Kansas Flint Hills, a grassland sea little changed over thousands of years. The undulating landscape, snow-dusted in winter, vivid green in spring, rusty red and brown in fall. is North America's last big chunk of tallgrass prairie. Hike into the hills at Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve in Strong City. Interestingly enough, if you're on the Jayhawk Highway, which is US 70, and you're coming out of Topeka, you'll come out of the right, you will see the old Menninger Clinic. You know, that's now moved to Baylor in Texas, but for years it was based there just outside of Topeka. It's up on the right-hand side. On the left, you begin that Flint Hills Prairie, and it is spectacular. You can't miss it. Number seven is Maine. Rangeley Lakes Scenic Byway, small falls to just north of Byron. Maine is more than lobsters, lighthouses, and rocky coasts. Go west near the where the state meets Canada and New Hampshire to discover inland sites, mountains, lakes, moose, loons, and fabled sunsets. And then top photo stop along the 36-mile byway, the height of land overlook on Spruce Mountain, with views, and I get a hold of this name here, Moose Look Meguntic Lake. That's right, Moose Look Meguntic Lake. Took me a while to figure that one out. And it's wild Toothacre Island. Toothacre Island. Then we move on to Michigan. Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, excuse me, and Munising to Grand Marais. And we have mid-September to early October, the hardwood forests glow bright red, yellow, and orange on the northernmost coast of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Take in the fall colors on a 52-mile drive along Lake Superior's Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, home to sand dunes, colorful sandstone cliffs, beaches, waterfalls, and the 300-foot-high Grand Sable Banks. Number nine is Minnesota. North Shore Scenic Drive, Duluth to Grand Portage, Minnesota 61. Follow the Lake Superior shoreline, 142 idyllic miles north from Duluth to the Canadian border. Along the way, explore eight state parks like Gooseberry Falls, a favorite of Rosemont, Minnesota native Dem Gojentin. There are beautiful waterfalls throughout the park and coastal cliffs that makes for excellent hiking, Kajetan says. You can even match the northern lights if your timing is right. And number 10 for today's episode is Washington State, Strait of San Juan de Fuca, Scenic Byway, State Road 112, Nia Bay East to U.S. 101 west of Port Angeles. A top contender for 61 of the state's most wonder-filled miles. This rambling byway follows the Strait of Juan de Fuca, a glacial fjord connecting Puget Sound to the Pacific. Pull off at viewpoints to watch for bald eagles, whales, sea lions, harbor seals, and if conditions are good, dazzling rainbows and sunsets. Wow. Well, we're going to feature 10 more states in Gately Williams' 50 States Road Trip on the next edition of Armchair Traveler. In fact, we're going to break it down to 10 states each for a few episodes, so be looking forward to that. Now we're going to head to the state of Oregon for Wine and Trails in the Columbia River Gorge. Sally Carpenter Hale's article appeared in the April 22, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. Ms. Hale, by the way, is a writer for the Associated Press. Hood River, Oregon is our dateline. The Columbia River Gorge is a marvel of nature, known for spectacular waterfalls, scenery, and hiking. But it's also famous in the world of wine. The region's geology has given rise to a wine industry that's growing in both number and reputation, with more than 40 wineries within a 40-mile, 60-kilometer stretch. In 2004, the Columbia Gorge was designated an American Viticultural Area, a wine grape region distinguished by geographic features. Here's a look at the gorge, the wine region, and wineries, along with what visitors need to know about the wildfire that made headlines last year. And there is a spectacular picture of the Multnomah Falls. It's a huge falls. It just falls, at least 20 or 30 stories tall. And it's amazing to watch this thing. And it's the picture of a crowd looking at it in early spring. Anyway, Gorge Falls and Fire. The gorge is an 80-mile-long canyon with dozens of waterfalls spilling down towering cliffs. The most famous is Multnomah Falls, 620 feet high. The Columbia River cuts through the gorge on its way to the Pacific Ocean, forming the boundary between Oregon and Washington through the Cascade Range Mountains north of Mount Hood and past heavily forested hillsides and huge boulders. Interstate 84 on the Oregon side of the river and Highway 14 on the Washington side offer easy access to trailheads, viewpoints, and rugged parks. The Windy Gorge is also a favorite spot for wind and kite surfers. A wildfire burned more than 20,000 acres of the gorge last fall, but little evidence of it can be seen from the road, aside from a very few scorched trees cut down just east of Multnomah Falls. The lower viewing platform at the falls has reopened, though the trail to the upper platform remains closed. An updated list of the status of hiking trails and recreational areas is available online. That's fs.usda.gov/recmain, RECMAIN/CRGNSA/recreation. Again, fs.usda.gov/RECMAIN/CRGNSA/recreation. Now to the wine region. Many of the wineries are clustered around Hood River, an hour east of Portland. Wine tasting in the region is a relaxing contrast to the Willamette Valley south of Portland, where traffic and crowded tasting rooms can detract from the experience. Tasting fees are comparable, $10 to $15 per person. Wine tasting was our mission one day while in Portland for a reunion show by my husband Rick's rock band. We rented a party bus and filled it with 16 people, college buddies from around the country, and local friends and family. With a soundtrack of classic garage rock, we headed across the Columbia and east on Highway 14 past Wind Mountain, Dog Mountain, known for its spring wildflowers, and Beacon Rock State Park. We saw the Bonneville Dam, which generates enough electricity to power 500,000 homes. We passed the Bridge of the Gods, a steel truss cantilever bridge that leads to Cascade Locks, Oregon. Nearby Stevenson, Washington, is home to Skamania Lodge, a resort that features 254 guest rooms, two restaurants, a golf course, an outdoor zip line and aerial park, and on-site hiking trails. Stevenson also offers many restaurants and watering holes, such as the Walking Man Brewery, to those just passing through. The wineries. At Core Cellars in Lyle, Washington, we were treated to a lovely view of Mount Hood. The winery, founded in 2003 by Luke Bradford, produces 10 wines just west of the boundary between the Columbia Gorge and Columbia Valley AVAs and uses grapes from both regions. Core has won acclaim for its Cabernet Franc, Malbec, Cabernet Franc Rose, Alba White, and a blend of Griffith's Tremena and Pinot Gris. We especially like the 2015 Cab Franc. Picnicking is welcome in the courtyard garden. Next, we head back to west and head back west and cross the Columbia to Hood River for lunch. Now, the town has a huge beer scene, Full Sail, Pifriam, and Double Mountain among the breweries, but that tour would have to wait for another day. We settled in at Solstice Wood Fire Cafe and sampled some unusual and delicious pizzas, including a cherry and chorizo pie and one made with local Cremene mushrooms. Of Hood River's 15 wineries, we chose two, Viento Wines and Cathedral Ridge Winery. Viento's winemaker, Rich Cushman, is a Hood River native who founded the winery in 2007. Viento sources most of its grapes from several area vineyards, but the winery grows its own Riesling in a vineyard planted by Cushman in 1981. Viento has earned high marks for its Verona, a blend of Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc, and for its Syrah and Sangiovese. We thought the 2014 Pinot Noir was delicious. Of the three wineries, Cathedral Ridge had the largest selection, including several reserve wine options. The winery has won numerous awards, primarily for its reds. Winemaker Michael Savastini hails from the famous California winemaking family. Heading back to Portland, we uncorked a couple of bottles and vowed to return soon to explore more of the gorgeous gorge and its wineries. And if you'd like to go, the Columbia Gorge Wine Growers has a website, ColumbiaGorgeWine.com, ColumbiaGorgeWine.com. And you can also check out ColumbiaRiverGorge.info, ColumbiaRiverGorge.info. So both of those give you more information online. So that sounds quite a treat, huh? Well, so let's now return to our April-May 2018 issue here of the National Geographic Traveler. And what we're going to do is try to check out Detroit in the Smart Cities section of the newspaper. This is a special column featured each month in the magazine. And this particular one, writer Ashley Sladopolsky introduces her article, and it includes tips on where to eat, stay, places to see, and so forth in Detroit. Newly waxed and buffed, America's Motor City is cruising with a new optimism, she writes. Its automakers are designing self-driving cars. Hometown watch and bicycle brand Shinola is opening a Shinola Hotel. And movie makers are eyeing miles of vintage Detroit streetscape for films. Tiny Homes Detroit is building cozy microhouses for low-income residents, an initiative making national news. And the arts here are on a roll, says Susan Mosey, executive director of Midtown Detroit Incorporated. In Midtown alone, Wayne State University is building a new repertory theater and a new jazz center. The Motown Museum is expanding, and murals in market continues to grow, she notes. Detroit is aiming high. How high? Well, ask locals, and they'll point to the gleaming skyscrapers and new eateries along the Detroit International Riverwalk, soon to be boosted by a promenade through a defunct tire plant. Motown is purring along, and how sweet it is. Well, let's take a look at some places to eat. Comfort Cooking, potato donuts, corn dog roulettes, and Lady Hatton's are on tap at Lady of the House, where chef owner Kate Williams declares, "We are throwing a party every night." Head to Detroit Vegan Soul's two branches for plant-centric dishes, mac and cheese, catfish tofu, sourced with local providers, and leftovers to help fertilize farms. On chilly nights, you can warm up with the steaming undone noodles at award-winning Emma in Corktown. Sweet Tooth calling Midtown's Avalon International Breads has lured patrons and been a community supporter since 1997 with its cinnamon brioche buns and sea salt chocolate chip cookies. Now, how about where to stay? Well, the past is prologue. The Detroit Foundation Hotel, once headquarters of Detroit's fire department, has retained firehouse designs and details. 100 guest rooms pair salvaged wood with exposed brick, while subway tiles wall the hotel's apparatus room restaurant. Another Motor City totem, the 1915 David Whitney building, was restored to include an aloft hotel. High-flying guest quarters overlook such Detroit landmarks as the Opera House. Prefer an earth-friendly getaway powered by solar panels? The Elmore Lodge has you covered with guest rooms and four rooftop urban cabins featuring sustainably sourced decor. Then we have what to play, where to play. Mountain, or rather Motown must. Take in the Detroit River as you jog the promenade of the Detroit International Riverwalk, past the glass-clad skyscrapers of the Renaissance Center to MacArthur Bridge and Belle Isle, where you'll find a park, lighthouse, an aquarium, and the Dawson Great Lakes Museum, known for its trove of model ships. Return to Midtown to the 135-year-old Detroit Institute of Arts to view the Diego Rivera's mural series Detroit Industry, and you end at the Motown Museum, once the recording studio of music legend Berry Gordy, who championed top talent such as Diana Ross and Stevie Wonder. And what about the shop? Well, Detroit made. The city's retail culture hums at Eastern Market, one of the largest historic U.S. public market districts. Step into Division Street Boutique for clothing from the Detroit Hustle's Harder line, a proud mainstay of local streetwear. Hightail it to well-done goods for Detroit-themed items, including neckties made with car seat leather. In Midtown, find specialized watches and bicycles and leatherwares. At Shinola, when you think manufacturing, you think Detroit. Shinola factory Tom Crisitas has said, "The city has given us a bear hug." And Tom there, with his quote, has given us the end of another great journey. And we hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Armchair Traveler, that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.